This is fun.
Log Talk Radio.
Well, it's about time I'm back on the air. Just when you thought you could get rid of me, you can't. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Literary Viewpoints. And this is going to be a phenomenal show because we've got internationally famous author of my favorite series, Caitlin Strong, Blake McCacken, and my new favorite guy, Michael Toriano. He's gorgeous. Oh, my God. And that's John Land. Hi, John. I can't get the chat.
Hi, Fran. I was wondering who you were talking about.
Yeah. I don't know. And we have internationally famous author of the Craig Page series, which is a other favorite series, and the Washington Lawyer, Alan Topol. Hi, how you doing?
Hi, Fran. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I don't know what's wrong with this chat room thing. It's not starting. I have no idea. Oh, well, I'm not going to worry about it. Okay, today's show is different. Literary Viewpoints today is going to talk about how you begin your novel. When do you know exactly that this is the right moment to start your novel with whatever paragraph you start? Do you start with flashbook, historical event, something related to your character's prologue, or how do you begin each novel? Now, John, you have three series, so do you start them all differently, or do you start them the same?
I start them all the same. And when you talk about each individual installment, I don't outline. I don't do a lot of preparation. I start thinking about a book months in advance, and I think my imagination does most of the work for me as far as figuring out where things are going to go. I write by the seat of my pants. I don't outline. So there's not a lot of prep work. There's not a lot of anything that gets done in advance besides thinking about the book. And it really doesn't become real until the day I really get going. And then it's a mindset. And the mindset for all my fiction is pretty much exactly the same. You know, I know where I'm going, and I have a rough idea of how I'm going to get there. But the fun for me of writing, the challenge and the fun, is not knowing what's going to happen next from one day, sometimes literally to the next day. Because if I don't know what's going to happen next, the reader can't possibly know what's going to happen next. I think in writing thrillers, the more spontaneous the plotting appears. Now, let's face it. It's not a question of whether it's really spontaneous, because it's not. It's contrived in the sense that we're making up the action. But the more that it appears to be spontaneous, and the master of this is Lee Child with Jack Reacher. That's the character. I've always looked at Caitlin as a female Jack Reacher. And where I fail, where almost everybody else fails, where Lee succeeds, is that we watch, and Lee writes the same way I do. That's why I use him as an example. We watch Reacher's thought process evolve, how he moves from step A to step B. That creates the action unfolds interactively, Reacher with the reader instead of Reacher to the reader. And I think that's because Lee doesn't know what Reacher is going to do or think next. I don't know what Caitlin is going to do or think next. Therefore, how can the reader know? And that makes it, I think, makes the writing fresher, more alive. People ask, how do you keep a series fresh? How do you keep it from getting stale and redundant? And one of the ways you do it is in each world you create for your series characters, you're presenting them with entirely different challenges than they had in the book previously, not just structural, not just plot-wise, but also emotional. What are they facing that can change their lives, not just their fates, not just the fates of the world? What makes us care? And in closing on that question, what it comes down to me is the definition of story that was coined by John D. MacDonald, the great novelist and thriller writer who created the Travis McGee stories series. And MacDonald, asked to define story one day by a young writer, simply said, stuff happens to people you care about. And I always keep that in mind when I'm writing.
I keep thinking about that every morning when I get up now. So, Alan, how do you start yours? Because you've got two series, and they're totally different. And the last one, The Washington Lawyer, started off with a really cool murder. That was really good.
Okay, well, I guess, you know, Fran, let me say this. Let me give you two thoughts. First, approach, it's good that you have me and John together on this because you couldn't have two diametrically opposed opposites as far as... In this respect, answer you in two respects. First of all, strongly been influenced by Al Zuckerman and Ken Follett. So I start off with a 40-year outline before I write a single word, and I start off with bios of my characters. Now, that's not to say I'm going to stick with the outline. Of course, not paint by the numbers, and I'll throw it out when it has to be. But the detailed outline. So that's the first thing. I mean, my sort of theory is you wouldn't build a house if you didn't have detailed plans. All right, so that's first. Now, secondly, in terms of your question of how do you begin your novel, I always try to begin with an action scene that will grip the reader from the get-go. I think that's key. As you said, The Washington Lawyer begins with begins with a naked woman on a beach in Anguilla in the Caribbean. She's a former model, a congressional staffer who's gone off with a powerful senator, the head of the Services Committee, in Anguilla, and that launches the novel, and I want to grab the reader. Now, I have almost always taken that initial scene from trying to have an action scene that grabs the reader and made it the beginning of the action, and then the book evolves from there. But once in a book, it was a Craig Page book. As you know, The Washington Lawyer was my one departure from Craig Page among my last five books. But in a book, The Spanish Revenge, I did something that I never did before. I took an action scene which really came in the middle of the novel, and I put it up front because I thought it was such a good, gripping scene. I wanted to lead with that, and I didn't think it or so much. I tried to mask it so the reader wouldn't feel, gee, there's no point reading. But on the other hand, I did that, and actually, that worked well. That was the only time scene from the middle. It was kind of an experience. I was sort of happy with it. But the short answer to your question is wrong action scene. You've got to grab the reader those first 8 or 10 pages.
Don't forget. Fran, can I weigh in on that?
Yeah, you got to grab me on the first paragraph, people.
well, you know, I think what Alan is saying is spot on as far as starting with something that grabs the reader. I think for your audience out there that is writers and is looking for, you know, for that might maybe taking notes right now.
Me, I am.
Well, there you go. There's a couple points to keep in mind. One is that that most thrillers, and that's almost all thrillers, actually have two openings. One is the prologue. And the prologue, and this is where I do agree with Alan, but I want to go one step further. Grabbing the reader doesn't mean just grabbing them because of the action that's unfolding. Grabbing the reader in the prologue specifically is about leaving some kind of cliffhanger in the prologue that makes the reader want to come back and find out what is going on. I learned this from Clive. You know, I think a lot of my prologues rip off classic Clive Cussler. Something happens historically that doesn't even involve the hero, and this is what I mean about two different beginnings to every thriller, or most thrillers. One opening, that's the prologue, doesn't even, may not even, and probably doesn't in most cases, even involve the hero. The hero is not present in the prologue. But what's happening in the prologue, specifically the cliffhanger in with which the prologue ends, will directly impact whatever quest, whatever the hero is doing.
Mm.
Starting with chapter one, my rule is that I always introduce my hero in chapter one, because I've diverted for the first two or three scenes or one scene, depending on how long the prologue is. Now, here is where I 100% concur with Alan. Every one of my Caitlin Strong books begins either with an action scene or a scene featuring Caitlin, a la the openings of all the James Bond movies, where she does something either connected or even not connected to whatever the plot of the book is specifically about. But a scene, and this is to Alan's point, that immediately showcases what and who she is. Caitlin's a Texas Ranger. She's a gunfighter. So chances are she is going to be seen in chapter one and probably chapters one through four, because I write very, very short chapters, doing what it is she does. So I think it's important. Now, I can only talk about writing the thriller. I can't talk about writing other forms of fiction, because thriller is really what I know. So I think it's very important for your listeners and writers out there to realize that the form of the thriller, and I don't want to call a formula a paradigm, but essentially it is, of every great thriller almost that I've read, not all, but the vast majority, and I'm have a prologue that sets up the story and makes me want to get to the hero in chapter one.
Yeah, well, you know, Steve Berry does that too. He did that in the Patriot Threat.
And James Rollins does it, and David Morrell does it. I mean,
David Morrell does it very well, and you guys make me think too much. And
sorry.
It makes it hard for this. That's all right. My mother always told me if it's too easy, it's not worth doing. And that I have it in my brain, which means you answered the next question about introducing your main character, which brings me to page two. Okay. Both authors, I don't know what happened to Dennis Palumbo, but whatever. If you create your novel, do you base it on a historical event, or do you incorporate it in it? Because you did in The Black Scorpion, which, by the way, my sister-in-law took and won't give it back. And Alan, your book my cousin took and she won't give it back. But luckily for me, I've got two of each one. So do you use historical event and relate it to the book, or is it just like to set the interest in the reader?
Okay, well, let me, if I can kick this one off. Fran,
go ahead.
For me, what I do is I am interested in having a serious geopolitical issue as an integral, so that on the one hand, it's meant to be a thriller where the reader will follow the action, turn the pages, and it's meant to have the reader think about a geopolitical issue in the world that's critical to the book. In the revenge, it's the growth of Muslims in Western Europe. In the China Gambit, it's the increase of Chinese power and what it means for the U.S. In the Russian Endgame, it's Russia and China coming together. So these, for me, these are, I'll weave in a little history from the relationship so that the and the geopolitical issue, but I'm really concerned about writing about this geopolitical issue, but not letting that the flow and pace of. That's where I kind of am on that.
Oh, I can actually could send a message here. For some reason, I'm having trouble turning on the chat room, but I'm sure eventually it'll get on by itself. It doesn't really matter. Okay, so, John, you use historical events, too, but not all the time. You do when you go with the Caitlin Strong mysteries. You did one with her father and Wesley's father and the pesticide issue, correct?
Yes, so, I did. Strong Light of Day. That's Strong Light of Day.
That's Strong Light of Day. Strong Light of Day was
really
good.
Yeah, that's
the
one that's coming out October 13th.
I know I have it marked on my calendar to mark to do the to pocket, you know, the five stars on Amazon that day. I shouldn't tell you. Yeah, it's great. It was a good book. And of course, I had to think a little, but you know, it's okay, people. So do you ever find that there are too many, when people write novels, now I can follow yours and I can follow Alan, and sometimes I have trouble following other people and I need to get my little graphic organizer out there, which is not good. Do you find that some write with too many flashbacks and too many plot lines? Just how many fits right in? I mean, some people
That's a great question. And, you know, if you, what it comes down to is juggling. And there are some people who can juggle five balls. And there are some people who can't juggle two. And I'm talking about literally, I'm talking about jugglers. And it's there is no one answer to that. I think it's a question of instinct and it's a question of timing. For instance, you know, because flashback, which almost which very rarely works in film, is a vital component of the novel, not just thrillers, but the novel in general. And the reason for that, and there are two different kinds of flashbacks, and I think we need to differentiate them. One is a flashback that establishes character and helps us understand a character better. What happened in a character's past that is determining who they are in the present. And that goes to the development of that character, and we hold back and the truth, and the only way to show the truth is either through dialogue, internal monologue, and internal monologue is essentially flashback. That is character flashback, and it's specific to development. The flashback of structure is setting up either a strand of a plot. Now, what I do with the Caitlin Strong books is there's always a historical subplot which pertains directly to what Caitlin is investigating in the present.
Right.
Now, you mentioned you mentioned the only time a criminal, you know, Caitlin's boyfriend's father, the legendary criminal Boone Masters, and Caitlin's, you know, Court Wesley's father and Caitlin's father, Jim Strong, actually worked together on a case. And there are two things to keep in mind with that. When you flash back to that historical subplot, you are watching something which directly pertains to the present. And the clues for Caitlin to solve what's going on in the present partially lie in what's going on in the past. At the same time, there are secrets that are revealed that Caitlin was unaware of. And what I'm saying is, and this is, I think, a crucial point from a writing standpoint of technique, the difference between a good flashback and a great flashback is the direct relation it bears to not only the plot of the story, but also the characters and their fates. That makes it direct. William Faulkner wrote that the past isn't gone. It's not even past. That's the point, I think, of using flashback in the story. But I think what you were alluding to before, and this is another great point for thriller writers out there, all writers to a lesser extent, but especially thriller writers. And when you reference Steve Berry and James Rollins and Clive Cussler and others in that same, you know, who write with that historical reinvention in mind, which I do as well, you're using your opening flashback as a hook to grab the reader, exactly as Alan was saying earlier. Even if and it may not be revealed how it pertains to the plot, the overriding plot, for hundreds of pages into the book. And the trick is to craft it in a way and have reminders of it planted in a way that make the reader say, oh, now I get it. A light bulb goes off. Because the worst thing you can do, and this is something Tom Clancy was so guilty of in his later work, he would give you a scene early, but by the time you got back to it, you had forgotten it even existed. So he's planting clues or doing a revelation, which is not really a reveal, because you've forgotten what it is he's revealing anything about. So it's
I just read a book like that. I just read a book like that, and I won't say who it is, New York Times bestselling author, and I read a book like that, and they created this murder and whatever at the beginning, and I'm going like, when are they going to get to what they're looking for? And it took about 400 pages to get to the end, and I'm going like, Oh, that's nice. And it gets rough because you don't want to give a New York Times bestselling author 3 stars, but oh well, what could you do? And then, of course, you get one of your books or one of Alan's books, and, you know, it's a whole different ball game here. So you're right. I mean, exactly that. I don't mean Tom Clancy anymore, people. Anymore. Uh-uh. So, next question. The cover of the book. I don't know what the new cover is going to look like. How does the cover... I never get them with the new cover. I get them, like, the before it comes out.
I know.
How does the cover match the title? And what about the copy on the back cover and the book flap? How do you decide what the reader should know about and what they shouldn't? Because I know when I interviewed Iris Johansson recently, it was one of the books, and I said to her, I can't believe that you let that pass on the cover. I figured out who did it just by reading the book flap. And she said I was right. I wouldn't read the book flap on there because I wouldn't do that to her ever. She's great. And I know what I'm not allowed to ask. I'm not allowed to ask any questions about the book. I have to skirt around it. It gets hard. So what about the back cover and the copy? And then what about if you wanted to delete something and change it? Would they let you?
And who do you want to go first on that, Fran?
We
I don't care. Alan, go ahead.
Who, you want me to go? Okay.
Go
all right,
ahead.
Well, let me say this.
I'm just sitting back with my eyes closed.
Okay, on back... On cover and on cover copy is I found on, and I've had 3 publishers, so I've worked with Morrow, I've worked with Penguin, and now I'm working with Select Books, small high quality outfit in New York that did 4 of my novels, although I'm one of their only 2 fiction authors, which is kind of fun. Anyhow, so what I've found is that the publishers have always given me, they've drafted the given me shot at it, and as well as the cover itself, and they've always listened to my input. But I've had a couple of things that have bothered me. One, I had these discussions with my editor at Penguin. I said, you're giving away too much of the story.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
The cover copy. I said, don't give away. And this editor, who shall go nameless, who was then an experienced editor, his response was, well, the readers, by the time they read the book, will forget what they read in the cover copy. And
no, they
really
won't.
Interested in grabbing them in the bookstore, and we don't care beyond that. All right? So that's, I mean, I lost on that one, but I still hate that. And so when I pick up a book or my wife picks it up, I'm sort of torn. It's like movie reviews. Do I really want to read the cover copy? Because the prevailing wisdom is to give away too damn much of the story, and I sort of hate that. So that's kind of one. And the other thing, which is an interesting question, and I'd really be interested to hear how John and the others weigh in on this, that's assuming you have a say and your publisher gives you an input, how do you feel about what goes on the cover in terms of quotes? On the one hand, it's great to have these quotes from other authors, from fellow authors, and says, you know, this is the best thriller I've ever read in 10 years and yada-da. But hey, those of us who are in the business know how those are generated and how those go. And so, you know, we take those with a certain grain of salt, and I wonder if the readers don't do the same thing. Now, on the other hand, if you have a quote from the Washington Post review or from, you know, whatever, a New York Times review, to me that carries more weight. You're being ridiculous because they selected the reviewer and what the relationship there. And I don't know, I'd kind of be interested to hear on those issues of how much to disclose and whose quotes. I'd be interested to hear what John and your other panelists say.
To be very honest, this panelist gets her quotes in your book. Ha! They've quoted me like 3 times in each one of your books, so I'm glad to be there.
Well, because you have a following, Fran, so I want to quote you. Yeah. I mean,
Yeah, I was like, yay, I got quoted. As a matter of fact, I just read for the first time, and I was like, I got a book called Forgiving Mariela Camacho by A.J. Sadowski. It's phenomenal. The first book was great. This one's better. And I'm reading all those, like you just said, quotes on the press release. And there on the middle of the page was my quote from Just Reviews. And I read it three times. I go, oh, my God, I actually got on somebody's press release. I was so excited. It didn't say my name, it just said Just Reviews, but I know it's me. So I felt like my quote actually meant something to them. The one thing that you won't get me to write is that's the best thriller in the whole world. That's like, you're right. It's I don't know. John, what do you think?
I let me start with what Alan, where Alan finished, because I think that's what he wanted to comment on.
Yeah.
And that's specifically with quotes. I do use quotes. Blurbs, because there's two different ways, you know, a review quote or a blurb, and I use a combination of both. There's now with a cover, there is a formula that goes into mine. It starts with the cover. There's three elements of what we're talking about here. One is the cover design, and the designer at Forge, who's designed all my Caitlin Strong covers, actually reads the book. He actually reads the book, and what he tries to do in the cover is capture a snapshot that gives you the feel of the book without saying anything about what it's about. The Strong Light of Day cover, if you go on Amazon and blow it up and look at it, you'll see that Caitlin Strong, my female Texas Ranger, is standing on a boulder or a ridge, and she's gazing out down a road into the sunlight. And what is suggested is, obviously, since she's standing above the road looking down into the sun, something is coming that she has to stop. But the thing I love about what Peter, who's the art designer for the books, did is you see her gun is stuck into her belt. You it's a silhouette. You see her from behind. It's actually an amazing, like, shadowy figure. The fact that she's not holding her guns kind of suggests, at least subconsciously, that whatever's coming, a gun's not going to kill it. And I love that effect, and I love the way he uses light. Peter uses light when he designs my covers the same way I use light to describe scenes. Now, that's the cover art. In addition to the cover art, you have the copy. And what I do is on the inside flap at the top, right above the copy, will go a review quote from the last book, which is especially appropriate to Caitlin's character. Because when you do a series, you're trying to hook someone on something they may not have read before and may be reluctant to jump into in the middle. So you'd have a review quote at the top of the inside flap, which becomes that hook. It's a review quote as opposed to an author blurb. Then comes the catalog copy, which is vague enough, which I write myself the first draft, and then it may go through 100 drafts before it's finally settled upon. It's only about it can only be 250 to 300 words. It's saying enough without saying too much. It's baiting the hook. That's what the cover copy needs to do. Now, as far as author blurbs, I agree with Alan that all authors know know where they come from. But I think a lot of readers value them in the sense that if they see a cover quote, and I use one on the back and one on the front, I sometimes use more on the back depending on how many, you know, the company wants how many quotes they want. But you take a quote on the front cover by an author you want to consider yourself to be likened to. Like Lee Child provided the blurb for Strong Darkness. Steve Barry provided the blurb for Strong Light of Day. Now, the fact that I want a blurb on the cover by an author whose name is far more recognizable than mine, that's not hard to do. And I want it to be someone who has the same genre. So when when a reader sees their endorsement, because that's essentially what it is, the reader will go, well, if Steve Barry, Lee Child, Lisa Gardner, like this book and I like their work, then I will probably like this book, even though I'm not as familiar with the author as I am of those people. So in directly addressing what Alan is saying, all three things we're talking about, you know what they are? They're sales and marketing tools.
Yeah.
They are devices to help people to stimulate people to want to buy the book. It's the same reason, Fran, why it covers used to, the big thing you wanted with a cover in the old days, which was about 5 years ago, was you wanted your cover to be foiled and embossed. You wanted it to have all this art, graphic stuff, holograms, and maybe double covers where you lift up one and there's one behind it. Well, that doesn't matter nearly as much anymore. First off, because the art process has become so extravagant that you don't need embossing to draw attention.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, so many of our books are bought digitally, and so few books are displayed face out in bookstores, that it's a waste of money and time to foil and emboss a cover. That money is better spent on other kinds of sales and marketing tools. That said, it's all the things we're talking about. You put them in, they're all individual parts leading to a greater whole. There's the exterior package we're talking about now, and there's the internal package we talked about before.
I have to tell you that whenever I post my reviews for either one of your books or any of my books on Just Reviews, it's amazing. You know, I post things, and then 5 minutes later, I get 20 people that will say, I'm going to buy the book. I don't know.
Fran,
it's amazing.
Fran, John really makes, you know, one good point, which is really I want to emphasize for all of your other authors who are listening. You know, he said that, you know, he goes through maybe 100 or whatever number of iterations till you get the right cover copy. And I think that cover copy is so important because I have spent a fair amount of time in bookstores where I'm doing a meet signing. I'm not talking. I'm sort of standing there at the front of the store with a pile of people, meeting people and so forth and so forth. And again and again, after they hear my little speech, what the potential buyers will do is pick up the book, turn it over, and read that cover copy. I'm talking paperback. So really, for the writers who are on this phone listening, I really think it's terribly important to get that cover. Do what John says to sort of give away too much, but it is, don't just push or do it and stay out of the process. It's your book. So that's kind of what I think.
Well, the book and the cover copy and the book, do they blend in? Do they sort of match, or is it just like the cover? I look at the cover of the book and then go like, I have to read this, I have to see more. Then I'll look at the back cover, but basically I read the first page, the first couple of pages, to see if I'm interested. Because the cover copy is great, but if it doesn't catch me when I'm reading it, when I open up the book, forget it. That's it. I'm not going to take it. But then again, I won't ask for it either. I usually go into the bookstore and say, okay, let me see which ones I want to review, then send to the publisher if I find it's something I want to read. So the cover of the book and the back and the cover copy, do they match, or does it one thing have nothing to do with the other? Would they just sort of blend in?
It's a great question, and they have to match. They have to be organic, because if they're not, you're being disingenuous to the reader. But what you want, it's not so much what you say, it's how you say it and how much you say of it. For instance, in Strong Light of Day, the two big plot hooks early on are the mysterious, the 36 kids from a field trip vanish.
Yeah.
They disappear, literally, like, where do they go? I mean, there's no evidence of any trace that they were even ever there, but we know they were dropped off. And, a few chapters later, we see a farmer's herd of cattle that has been picked literally completely to the bone. There's nothing left. Now, any good thriller reader knows that these two events are connected. The fun of reading a thriller is finding out how and watching Caitlin figure everything out. But those two, what you want to create in your book, and this is to the point, if you don't have the right content in your book, you may not have enough to sell in your cover copy. But if you have the right content, if you have strong enough content, no pun intended, then you've got plenty to work with. The question then is, again, how much do you give away? How much do you raise? What the cover copy should do is raise enough questions in the mind of the reader that he or she wants to buy the book to get them answered. In the case of Strong Light of Day, what is it that wiped out that cattle herd? What happened to those kids, and how does it relate? Now, the other thing that you want to do is show why all that is important to the hero. In the case of Caitlin Strong and Strong Light of Day, one of the kids who is kidnapped or seems to have disappeared is her surrogate son, one of the sons of Court Wesley, the younger son of her boyfriend, Court Wesley Masters. So you involve an emotional attachment for the reader. Because here's the thing. Whether you're writing cover copy or whether you're writing an entire book, you have to engage the reader on an emotional level that makes them care. Give them something that makes them care. And when I read cover copy, and I do exactly what Alan is talking about, and I do it a little differently because I review books for the Providence Sunday Journal. So I probably get 50 books a month. And a lot of what I review I've already determined based on the big books that are coming out. But in determining whether I may review a book, I read the copy. And if it's the same thing about the burnt-out detective who tries to find the murderer of, that I know I'm reading, I know it's not for me. I want to see something that's fresh and original and intriguing enough to make me want to read on. And
What happens when you don't? That's the other question that people ask me too every day. What happens when you get a book, and I've got like 45 inside, and you're looking at the book and you're saying, the author sent it to me, and I really don't want to finish it, but I don't want to be mean and tell the author that what you wrote has no bearing or no meaning or it's destroying it. What do you do?
You basically forget the book becomes instantly forgettable. If you don't have the right cover quote, blurb on the front, the endorsement on the front, if all these things go together, you have to look at them as a whole. I'd like to ask Alan I'll give you mine. I wonder if you have one, Alan, that jumps out. But I can remember to this day, and it made me want to read the book, and it became the best book I ever read, Stephen King's The Stand, the original version, not the bloated one that came out years later. I was in a bookstore. I picked up The Stand, and I read, the old Chevy, and it was just a little snippet from the opening scene, and then it goes, but for the survivors of that dance of death, the worst was yet to come, because the walk. And I just remembered. I don't want to bore you by trying to recite it again now today. But the fact that I almost remember that entire cover copy 40 years later tells you the impact it had on me. And the amazing thing about The Stand was it was also the greatest book I ever read. But so I remember The Stand. In other words, greatest book I ever read and the best cover copy I ever read. Alan, do you have one that you remember that, a book that you read the cover copy and went, oh, my God, I've got to buy this book? What jumps out?
That's interesting because I was thinking as you were talking, and the book that pops into my mind, Trinity by Leon Uris, had great cover copy, had a fabulous cover that I can still see, and I started to read it, and I thought when I looked at it, hey, wait a minute, I'm not interested in Northern Ireland, not that interested to read this long book. It sure changed my mind, and now 95% of what I know about Northern Ireland I got from that book. But again, I was grabbed, as you said, by the cover copy, and as Fran said, I started to read. Oh, Fran, your book about I started to read is an interesting one because I've observed that in yours, too. A number of other people will then open the book and start to read it. And I said, mm-hmm. I asked them, because I'm there and this is gaining information, what are you looking for? And they said, well, mm-hmm. it's either one of two things. Will this book grab me? And then another one said, I want to find out if you can write. I'm an English teacher. I want to find out if you can write, because a lot of mm-hmm. books published are by people who can't write. I mean, I've had I don't like this, where somebody will take a book and say, they'll go upstairs to the snack area of Barnes & Noble and they'll read
it. Yeah, they read it.
Book, but I don't know if they buy it or they don't buy it.
here's an important point on that same note, Alan, I think, and Fran. In the old days, again, I'm saying the old days, it was 10 years ago. In the old days, cover copy, and I come out of mass market. I did my first 13 books were done exclusively in mass market paperback. So whether they were impulse buys and the cover copy was that and it was much shorter. The cover copy in the old days was read exclusively by people who had the book in their hands.
Yeah.
The reason why catalog cover copy is far more important today than it was then. Is because now it's not just read by people who are in bookstores. It's read by people who are browsing on Amazon or any of the other digital sales networks, where the thing they click on, that read more button, if your copy becomes a much more important sales tool, because you're not just relying on it for your bookstore buys, you're relying on it for your digital buys, because it's the only way your audience has. Now, here's the problem with that. When you revise copy at the last minute, like I did with Strong Light of Day, it doesn't necessarily make the transition to the digital format, because somebody at my publishing company has to physically go in and do it. And if I don't remind them to do it or ask them to do it, it doesn't get done. Now, again, here's yet another thing, and maybe, Alan, you would want to weigh on this as well. What works in the print the print cover copy may not necessarily be the first the thing that works best
in the digital
store copy. So if you, and this is actually advertent, if you look at the cover copy that's inside Strong Light of Day, it isn't the same as what's on Amazon, because what readers are looking for on Amazon and the other and iBooks and other means of delivery like that are different than what they're looking for in a bookstore where they're holding the book in their hands and you've already got them. On Amazon, you've got them for 10 seconds, 15 seconds. They might have clicked on your book by accident. They might have clicked on your book because it's been packaged with frequently bought together, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be customers who bought this also bought that. Or even better, when Amazon says, they'll send you an email, if you like this, try this.
Yep.
And then you've got that. Or BookBub, if you're doing a BookBub promotion or something like that. Because the way you have to look at yourself in this business is you are no longer an author, you are a brand. And when you're starting a book, you're also starting a promotional campaign to sell that book. And every time you write a new entry in a series, if you're not Lee Child, and neither Alan, unfortunately, we're not quite at that level yet. Of Lee, your books don't automatically sell. There's not a huge pre-order. Every book you write, here's the point, is like starting over from scratch. You have to both introduce your characters for the first time to a new audience, as well as introduce the fact that this is the next in the series to an old audience. And believe it or not, Fran, a successful package, and that's what we're talking about here before we move on to something else, a successful package has to do all those things.
I agree with it. But you know what? You made a point about saying about Amazon. I've noticed on Amazon that the cover copy that's in your book, as you said, is totally different than the one on Amazon, and sometimes they give away more than you would like them to on Amazon. I mean, where it says book description, It could be twice as long as what's on the back cover of your book because, you know, ever so often, when I'm posting a review, I read it. We've got about 15 minutes, but let me just say that there are four books that you might want to read. And my picks for the month are, I was honored, by the way, that Catherine Coulter sent me her new book, personally, The Endgame. It comes out September 22nd. Yeah, you want to read it. This is really fantastic. And what's great about it is she introduces some new characters, and it's not just Savage and Sherlock. It's Mike Michaela Caine and Nicholas Drummond. It's phenomenal. Everyone has their reasons about a man that was decided to go into the German police department, police precinct, and kill someone. He killed the wrong person, and he winds up at 17 years old in jail. Joseph Matthews is fantastic, too. To Live Out Loud, the story about how Emile Zola tried to save Alfred Dreyfus, Paulette Murin, and a surprise that I was surprised about, Killing Maine by Mike Bond. Absolutely fantastic. What really made me happy is when he emailed me and told me he liked what I wrote. So, yeah, that was like shock treatment. I go like, oh, my God, he liked what I wrote. And the book was really good about wind power and the wind industry. And, okay, final question. When you read a novel, I mean, I look at the first paragraph or the first chapter or whatever, and everyone gets drawn to a novel differently. John, how do you choose a book to review? How do you choose that book? You walk into the bookstore or a publisher is going to send you, you know, a request. How do you decide, yeah, I'm going to read this one or not, without just from the press release that they send you in an email? Because that's what I get, tons of them.
I immediately eliminate European authors being translated or published over here. I just don't think that I want to take care of American authors. I know that sounds a little insular. I know it may sound a little racist, not racist, but I mean, I review exclusively thrillers because I want to serve the genre. I review a tremendous amount of books by writers I know and already respect. So a lot of the reviews I do are taken up by names that you will see me review over and over and over again. And I always try to review, one, you know, if I'm doing a four book column, I want one of those books to be by a smaller press. I want to give attention because I know what it's like. I'm an author that, you know, who loves getting reviews and works very hard to get reviews, who also reviews. So I understand how important and how difficult it is. And I respect that. And I want to do so. I really like, with my relationship with international thriller writers, you know, I like doing reviews by smaller presses. Intrigue Publishing, for example, which is run by Austin Camacho, who's also a terrific writer and an ITW member. There are a number of, and I think, you know, that smaller presses, and I think this is the future of publishing. It's not just the big five. There are a lot of other print and digital publishers out there that are doing wonderful work and creating great sales avenues for their writers. So I want to, even though it's not equal, I want to review one of those. So it's kind of a balance. I want to try to do as many female authors as male authors. I want to do romantic suspense review romantic suspense, even though I don't necessarily read romantic suspense, because it's a huge staple of our genre. And not to review authors like Heather Graham, Sandra Brown is way beyond romantic suspense now.
Oh, Friction was phenomenal. Absolutely fantastic.
Oh, unbelievable.
Best book she's ever done. And you know who else?
She's done, you know, 30 number one New York Times bestsellers. She's been at this.
Oh, I loved
it. She's done almost 100 books, and she's writing better than she ever has. So, you know, what are you going to do? Sandra Brown's as good as it gets. So that would be my answer as far as reviews.
Yeah, well, you know what? You want to read another great author that just sent me the book personally autographed? Shadowfall, Laura Griffin, the Tracer series. It's romantic mystery suspense. And she's really very nice, too. I get them all. I never know what I'm going to get. You never know what I'm not going to get. So, Alan, do you review books, too?
I do not review books. And in terms of my own reading, for me, the author thing is kind of key as far as what I'm going to read, because I'm spending most of my reading time is on international geopolitical issues because it's research and background for what I'm going to be writing about. So I do a much less reading of thriller books, you know, say, than Hunt does. But for me, you know, author's kind of key. You know, have I liked, because I'm reading what I want to read, what I'm going to gain from, not for review. Have I liked this author's books? And if I have, then that, for me, that's number one.
So what is next for everybody? And before I forget, guess what, people? I'm on the air again Thursday. I decided I was going to beat this whole whatever and get myself back in gear. Stuart Schwashmesser wrote a book called The Organ Broker about black market organs and what happens when the rich get the organs first and everyone else has to wait. The book was really great. The following week, I have A.C. Birch, Homefront Journals, and the week after, Kenneth Wien. He's also a talk show host on All That Matters Radio. But it should be interesting. And then the week after, Fran's taking the week off, you know, to more dental work. What can I say? So what's next, everybody? And what am I getting next to read?
Well, what you're getting next from me, Fran, is you're going to get a book called The Italian Divide, which is coming out.
Oh, nice.
It's a contemporary thriller set in Italy, but it weaves in the history and current geopolitical situation. Italy begins with the murder of an Italian banker, involves Chinese trying to gain a foothold in Europe, and it's called Italian Divide because
of it. Is this Craig Page?
Yep, Craig Page.
Yay.
And Saf and Elizabeth. Elizabeth is back with him. They're back in business together.
Oh, so yay. That's good. Oh, by the way, you can't kill Lamoff. I said that to John Lesquois every time he kills off somebody of my favorite characters.
Hey,
I
only made that mistake once in my career, Fran, in a book called A Woman of Valor. I killed off this Israeli Mossad agent. Boy, was I sorry. Anyhow, John,
you can't kill off.
What are you doing
next? And John, you left a cliffhanger, and I won't say what it is, at the end of Strong Light of Day. And it's concerning me. That's all I will say about that.
I don't think you have to worry if it's what I think it is. Well, Strong Light of Day
comes out
October.
I'm not going to say what it is, but I got concerned and go, like, he didn't really do that to me. That would not be good.
No. You had nothing to worry about because you saw the bodies hanging from those telephone poles, you knew. That's why. Strong Light of Day, Caitlin's Lucky 7 adventure, comes out October 13th. And then, the one that we'll be talking about after that in June. And it just shows you that you just keep trying new things. I've joined forces with Heather Graham, who I consider to be one of the true icons, of suspense fiction and popular fiction today, and a great friend. We're doing a series together, and it's for Forge, my company. We're doing a series for it's sci-fi YA young adult crossover. It's called The Rising. And I am so excited about it. It's and if I'm not going to get if I'm not going to get to the New York Times bestseller list on my own, I'll get on somebody else's shoulders and they can carry me there. But it's great to do a collaboration like this with someone I respect so much and someone who I've always thought wrote a lot like me in a lot of ways. So it's called The Rising. It'll be out in June, first in a series. I get excited about all my books. My books are all like my kids, so it's like they're all my children, and you love them.
Well, when I told somebody that you guys were going to be on my show, they knew who you were. So don't think that you're just like Steve Berry or James Patterson, whose books I'm getting finally. Ha ha ha. He doesn't do interviews, but they are sending me. They sent me three already, and they were impressed with my review of Zoo. Well, what can I say? My brother-in-law took that one out of my hand and won't give that one back either.
Fran, we have to talk about this problem you have losing all your books. I mean, this is like...
Yeah, I know. It's horrible. I can't... my brother-in-law came to visit. We're doing renovations on our apartment finally, And he walked in, and he saw a strong light of day, and I go, you got to wait. You can't have that one yet. But he wants it. My sister-in-law, they did a giveaway, so she won it. So she's thrilled. My cousin came over, and she took the Washington lawyer. And then somebody else took the Patriot threat. Actually, it's my dentist who tortures me. His wife reads fiction. And so she's waiting to get Strong Light of Day also. And she's waiting to get the Argentine triangle. She might not get that because I'm not giving it up so fast. So in order for him not to give me too sharp a needle of Ovocaine, I make his wife very happy and give her my books. It works for me. Seriously.
You better like him. I mean, Al and I are going to be responsible for a lot of pain that he's going to induce. If you give him a book of ours he didn't like.
Well,
don't worry about it. It's very rare that I don't like, you know, it's rare that I don't like a book. It's just that I am reading one that has a lot of pages in it, and it is a large print. And I get what the author is saying because I usually do. It's just that I really wish he would have said it in 300 pages, and I'm trying to get through it in like an hour, but because my eyes are bugging out all the time, I can't always do that. But anyway.
Such a good point, by the way. There are so many books out there that would be a lot better if they were 200 pages shorter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was my question. When is a book too long? Because, I mean, some books lend themselves to being like 350. And then when they go on and on and on, and then sometimes they repeat. And they recap.
I'm going to give you the answer to that question in my opinion, and then I'm going to give you an example to illustrate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much when you're giving the reader information they don't need to understand the story better. Example, 11/22/63 by Stephen King, one of perhaps his most lauded novel ever, and one of the most bloated, unreadable things he's ever written, in the sense that he had a great concept that's been, even though it's been done before, and the first half of the book was impossible to put down. The huge bulk of the second half of the book is a character trailing Lee Harvey Oswald for 6 months before he assassinates Kennedy. Now, look, that's a great concept, but I don't need to know every single day, and that's pretty much what it was for those 6 months. I ended up skipping huge portions of that book, just like I used to do with Tom Clancy before I gave him up, because I didn't need to know what I was reading to understand where the story was going.
I agree with you.
I wasn't getting any new information. The fact that Oswald had scrambled eggs and pancakes the week before, the fact that he lived here and went there, none of that mattered to what I was trying to get to. And I think a good book, I think it was a great book that could have been outstanding and far more memorable if it had been 300 pages shorter.
I agree with you because, right, Al, what do you think?
I totally agree. I mean, for me, I'm targeting around 100K for words.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems there's no reason for a book to be, particularly a thriller novel, to be longer than that. Otherwise, you're, as John says, you got these passages that you're skimming. It's ridiculous. And one thing, when you pick up a book from really a well-known author and you see they're just too long and you say, well, wait a minute, was the publisher afraid to edit the writer? Is that what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Makes
and
sense.
I'm going to go you one better. And, you know, I tell it like, you know, I'm just going to be honest. And I'm going to, you know, I don't speak ill of the dead. I'm going to speak ill of the dead. Tom Clancy, with his co-authors, they could write the greatest book in the world, but he would send manuscripts back and say, you need to add 200 more pages. They would say to him, why? And his answer was, because that's how long it has to be. That is so wrong for the genre.
Right.
When you are now saying that the book has to be 500 pages. Why? Because it has to be 500 pages. A book needs to be as long as a book needs to be. Some books, like The Stand, need to be longer. Other books, I mean, people who read cozies, they need to be shorter. So the idea that you've got to have a book at a certain length just for the sake of it to me, makes absolutely no sense and is strictly ego or the inability of an author to listen to people who would tell him it's a great, it could be a great book at 400 pages, it's a boring book at 600 pages.
I agree with you because as a reviewer, I mean, like I said, I've got several books inside that are like 500 pages, 400 pages, and too many pages. And I picked up one the other day that just came. You know, usually, you know, review them in order of how they come, sometimes, not always. And I got a book that was 220 pages, and I read it in an hour, and I'm going like, this is a breath of fresh air.
Well,
another book that I'm going to add before we close is by a gay author, Ken Michaels, The Gay Detective. 220 pages of fantastic. I didn't expect it. He just blessed me for my review. It's about a gay detective that works in a police department and what happens when he becomes a television star and interviews gay authors and gay performers. And the book is fantastic. What I really love about it is the way they treat the topic and bring it out. And that's all I'll say about that because, John, you brought in some very interesting information in Strong Light of Day. And I can't wait to see how you continue with that. I thought it was great. But
this is your friend.
What?
Good.
That was really great. So I would like to thank everybody for coming on the show today. And I am going to do another panel show in December. If either one of you would like to write something for MJ7, I'm putting it together. Hopefully it will come out at the end of this month or beginning of next. And I'm trying something brand new. MJ Magazine is going to come out with Poetry from the Heart. So if anybody has any specific poems that they would like to add or add to this little small edition of MJ Magazine. It's called Poetry from the Heart, and we've got some brand new authors and other authors to send poetry. I thought it might be something different to get a new audience for my magazine. So if anybody wants to write for it, fine. So, Alan, your book, when is that coming out?
March.
The Italian Divide in March.
Italian Divide, March, yes. The Ides of March.
Yes. The Ides of March, yes, I know. That's a good month for me. And your book is coming out in June. And in between there, when is Michael Torian coming out again?
That we don't know yet.
I'm
going to
bug him until he writes it. I'm going to bug him until he writes it. Because everybody likes The Black Scorpion, and it was really good. So thank you guys so much for today. And Fran will be back on Thursday with the author of The Organ Broker, and next week with Homefront, Homeport Journals. And I have Alan Jacobson on November 10th. Yeah, should be interesting. And I have Brian Freeman, who wrote a book, believe it or not, a romance novel, sort of like a Candice Brunel novel, on November 19th, and Mike Bond on November 19th. And December is up in the air. We shall see. So thanks, everybody. Have a great day. The sun is shining. And thank you guys so much. I appreciate it. And have a nice day, and bye.
Thank you, friend.